Before we move on to tranquility, are there any leftover queries about joy other than how to get there? Yeah.
Sort of the word faith kept popping up in my mind when you're talking about joy and talking blind faith. And is there some element of faith just that, I know this is all, it's all very reasonable and you can understand this, but it seems like at some point there's some element of faith involved here, that this will happen.
I think there is an element of faith, for sure. Confidence, and most of us don't start on the path with a lot of faith. I think that's a reality for most people, that they certainly don't start on the path with unshakable faith. And I do think that faith comes, in different ways into our lives. I mean, I know when I started to practice that the sort of beginnings of faith for me were being able to look around me at people who had actually, who were cultivating this path, had brought some of this path to maturity, and just seeing the embodiment of it. And that was so unmistakable that, I was absolutely certain that they knew something I didn't know. And it would be different if that was just one person, but to see, many people who were actually embodying that, it was kind of unarguable that there was something going on here. And just the authenticity of it. The authenticity of their happiness, the authenticity of their compassion, the authenticity of their joy was simply unarguable. So, that was a kind of visible face for me, that there was something they understood that I didn't understand, but that clearly was reachable. Clearly was reachable. I think the other part is that I think it's very important to have teachers who have faith in us. Again, just thinking of myself in the early years of my practice, where certainly doubt was far stronger than faith, to me it was quite a remarkable revelation to be training with people who seemed to have this quite amazing, and to me, I didn't know where it came from, but quite amazing faith in my capacity to do this. Didn't quite make sense to me at the time. I don't know quite where that faith came from. But that was also unmistakable and authentic. And I think there are times in our lives when we are carried by the faith of others in us. And that's very important because faith for most of us is rooted in a growing depth of experiential understanding and experiential fruitions, or at least blossoms. Most of us, our faith is based in that. But, I don't know how it was or is for all of you when you began to practice, but the early days of my practice was not a stream of good news. It was really hard, and I didn't know what I was doing, and there were no fruitions and hardly a hint of blossoms. But, there's something, faith comes in a way almost from others, sometimes before it comes from within ourselves. Yeah.
Any difference between happiness and joy?
I think piti and sukha are almost used interchangeably. I think there's a way that piti is used quite specifically in relationship to concentration practices. But I think in the factors of awakening, piti and sukha are pretty much of the same landscape.
Then there's a joy that can come in the mindfulness and the awareness of that.
Yeah.
But were you also saying that could fall away? I mean, that's because if I'm joyful because I'm mindful of it, but that's kind of getting into this self thing.
In the joy and the mindfulness? No, I don't know. I don't think I was saying that. I mean, personally, I think the very tenor of mindfulness is actually quite joyful. You know, I think it's almost in the fabric of mindfulness. That quality of wakefulness, immediacy, being present, being connected. I think within that, there is in that fabric a tenor of joy. I don't think mindfulness is in any way a neutral factor. I don't think it's attitudinally neutral, and I don't think mindfulness is emotionally neutral either. It's not a sort of bland, you know. Yeah. So I wouldn't expect the joy in mindfulness to drop away. Because I'm also, you know, and I want to kind of. That's okay. Give yourself a break here, you know? That's okay. Really, it's okay, you know, because I think we spend so much of our time saying, you know, I'm not mindful, I'm, you know, I'm not awake, I'm dull, you know, I'm not this and not that. Personally, I think it's perfectly all right to say, you know, I'm mindful. And then I think the I am is what falls away, you know, not the joy of it. But I don't think, you know, don't, that's okay. It's okay, you know. After all, it did not happen outside of your efforts and, you know, as much as you lay claim to your efforts and your energy and your dedication, neither is the fruition, you know. But you can use that, of course, quite lightly. You can hold that quite lightly, but there's no need to, I think, to feel that it's somehow subverts the reality of that moment or the actuality of that moment. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about pasadi. Tranquility. It's often translated as tranquility, but again, it's one of these Pali words that has lots of nuances. Tranquility, serenity, calm. And again, just to do my broken record thing here, we need to keep shifting ourselves out of the idea of states and one state versus another. Because we are really talking about cultivating calmness in the midst, again, of all changing states. So it's not calmness present here and absent because there's agitation. You know, we are really talking about an attitudinal quality, a heart quality that is brought to all states and experiences. Now, again, I think we can often associate calm as being one of meditation's byproducts. But here I just want to really point out again how calm is preceding concentration. You know, it's really talking about a quality of heart that precedes concentration. However, it is also true that calm arises from concentration. Now, this quality in particular, I think it's so important to turn calm into a verb. So we're really speaking about calming the body, calming the mind, and calming the formations that arise in the mind. So we're talking about calming the different mental states that arise. We're talking about calming craving, about calming aversion, about calming greed, calming anxiety. So it's really, again, it's so much a relational word rather than, you know, some experience having an independent self-existence. You know, it's very much a relational word and in relationship to what is not calm. So calming is a very specifically an antidote to the hindrance factor of restlessness and worry. Very specifically in relational to agitation, although we can see that agitation is something certainly that runs through ill will. It's a lot of agitation and ill will. We can also see how much agitation and worry runs through craving. So, in fact, a lot of, apart from sloth and torpor, if you look at the other hindrance factors, their kind of emotional tone is one of agitation. Doubt is agitated. You know, all of these hindrance factors are kind of storms. They're agitations of the heart. So calming has a lot to do with calming the hindrance factors, other than sloth and torpor, which needs the factor of energy. Doesn't need any more calming. So calming is about referring to a very specific sort of tone of non-excitement. Now, again, this is a little bit countercultural, I would say. It's probably an understatement. You know, culturally, our infatuation with excitement. You know, excitement making us feel alive. Excitement making us feel that we have meaning. You know, something is happening. You know, the idea of nothing happening is a kind of like a sort of death sentence, you know. So I think we have to really kind of take into account our infatuation with intensity and with excitement. Because calm is too often associated with boredom, with non-events. So look at how much of our attentiveness in our life is actually a stimulation-bound attention, which is why meditation is actually so difficult and challenging at times for us. You know, and at times why retreats are so difficult and challenging for us is because if we're accustomed to our attentiveness being triggered and stimulated, you know, and stimulation-bound, then of course you see that moving into environments where stimulation is really muted, what do? We go to sleep. We go to sleep. We zone out. It's like we are so accustomed to that, our aliveness being related to the aliveness of our external world and our reactions to it. So start taking that away. And, you know, there just seems to be this mind that just wants to sink into sloth and torpor or numbness. Now, of course, what meditation, what this path is asking us to really question is whether intensity is making us feel alive or whether intensity is making us feel excited. And they may not be exactly the same thing. And Joseph Campbell, in one of his books, writing, what we're really seeking for is the sense of being fully alive. And, you know, perhaps if we don't know the ways to find that within ourselves, you know, our next best choice is intensity, the intensity of phenomena, the intensity of experience, you know. It's even why, you know, at times in practice, you know, people get so kind of experience-centered, you know, I need to have some kind of experience to make my meditation worthwhile. So serenity is very much this contrast to intensity, excitement. Serenity values stillness. Serenity values contentment. Serenity values non-events. But that serenity is alive. You know, and if you look at the kind of metaphor that is often used in the teaching, how the Buddha often refers to cultivating a heart, a mind that is like a still forest pool that reflects everything that comes to it, but that is unagitated and unshaken by whatever is reflected. So if we turn calming into a verb, then we ask, what is it that we're calming? Well, everything that is agitated. I mean, we can wake up in the morning almost feeling like agitation is waiting for us, just like our shoes to step into, you know? The long list of things we have to do, finish, achieve, get rid of, you know, the busyness, the leaning forward, you know, the momentum of doing. But it's also important to see how agitation can become a habit. It can just become a habit, you know, the incessant inner squirm, you know, where the stillness, just contentment feels so far away. But we can feel, if we start to really look at what agitation is, you really get the felt sense of it in the body in terms of tightness, contractedness, tension. But you also see the residues or the ripples of agitation in the mind when we're leaning forward, or where there is a lot of impulsiveness or reactivity. And I think it's just helpful to be aware of how little wise action, how little wise speech, how few wise choices are born of the agitated mind. That often it's very inclined towards heedlessness and agitation, in my experience anyway, is very inclined towards residues. It's a kind of blind impulsiveness. So first we begin to calm the body, and if you really see this in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the instructions, you know, where the Buddha gives the instructions, you know, breathing in, knowing the whole of the breath, you know, breathing in, calming the body, breathing in, calming the mind, breathing in, calming the formations, are all there in the Satipatthana Sutta, as the primary instructions. So it is often helpful to first begin by calming the body, because, and you see how much attention is given to mindfulness of the body in Buddhist practice, and that's absolutely no accident, because it's the most accessible place of mindfulness. But we perhaps also become aware of how much the body is a vehicle for the agitated mind. Really see that. If the mind is agitated, it's pushing the body. And when the body is pushed, it's a sort of toxic loop where the mind becomes more agitated. So first we begin by calming the body, by being mindful of the body, calming the body. If you notice how the sense doors are affected by agitation, if the mind is agitated, notice how hungry your eyes become. You know, how hungry your ears become. I mean, even, you know, walking around this place. I mean, are you really, really deeply interested and educated by the variety of signs and posters in this place? Do you ever find yourself walking down the hallway and find yourself passionately absorbing the fact that Basir does this, you know? Has that nothing to do with your life, you know? it's a kind of, you know, the kind of beggar at the sense doors. Agitation makes us beggars at the sense doors, you know. We just become hungry, we just become prowling. But what are we doing? We're feeding the agitation, aren't we? We're just kind of filling up this space. I mean, in truth, our hearts aren't enriched or enlightened or liberated by all of this, but it keeps us busy. And it keeps us doing something. And doing something makes us feel that we are somebody. Huh? And we have a purpose and all of that stuff. But it's so interesting to notice how we're using our sense doors, because it's so much an indicator of the state of our mind. Huh? So much an indicator of the state of our mind. You know, I remember somebody at Gaia House on retreat once telling me, I think I've told you the story before, they're so agitated, you know, reading the housekeeping manuals, every sign, reading the tea boxes, and finally end up reading the instructions on the fire extinguisher. You know, and the second instruction on the fire extinguisher said, aim the nozzle at the base of the fire. And she said she suddenly got it. She suddenly really got it. That the base of the fire was the agitated mind state, and there was not enough sensory impression in the world to satisfy that. Because agitation, I think, also has so much craving and a sense of insufficiency mixed in that pool. It really has that flavor. If we're agitated, very easily it moves into craving. It's why, you know, certainly in contemplating feeling tones in the Satipatthana Sutta, when the Buddha talks about the underlying tendencies, for example, of the unpleasant is aversion, you know, the underlying tendency for the pleasant is craving. What is the underlying tendency for the neutral? Delusion. Disassociation. Disconnection, but how much that is a trigger for craving. That becomes a trigger for craving. Find something to fix that, to make that, you know, as if the neutral is somehow a kind of lethal disease. So it's really interesting to see how we lose our way when the mind is agitated, when the heart is agitated, how we lose our way, how we become very vulnerable to impulse. You know, you arrive at the tea urn, you weren't thirsty at all, you don't even know how you got there, but there you are. You arrive at a sign, you're not interested at all, you don't even know how you got there, but there you are. And it's good, I think it's useful for us to see how agitation and heedlessness go hand in hand. You know, and agitation and impulse go so much hand in hand. So craving, as I mentioned, is one of the hindrance factors that makes us agitated. I mean, there's so much agitation in trying to satisfy craving. And, you know, when we're agitated, it can feel like the whole of our life is in the service of discontent. And that's kind of not a happy way to live. It's not a happy way to live. More pleasant sensations, more pleasant sounds, more pleasant experiences, how to avoid the unpleasant, how to keep the pleasant going. This is such a state of tension. You know, I think this is what's called dukkha. You know, unsatisfactoriness. It's such a state of tension. Now, aversion, you can see how aversion makes us so agitated when we're trying to get rid of or trying to fix what we don't like or fearing the unpleasant that might come to us. So we start to calm by calming the body, turning this into a verb, you know, not a state. Calming the body, noticing when the body starts to move, pushed by impulse, pushed by agitation, remembering the possibility in that moment of nurturing the seeds of stillness, learning to pause, you know, learning to notice what is going on, learning to relax, learning to be present in the waves. Again, you really see how calming is working in conjunction with mindfulness. It's working in conjunction with mindfulness, because first there's the noticing of the agitation, and then there's the response to the agitation. You know, that's what we've been talking about wise effort, you know, about the how those are going together. That the mindfulness is inviting a response. The knowing is inviting a response. Where do we do this? In the midst. You know, where do we cultivate calming? Again, in the midst of worry and excitement. Now, calming the mind. You can see how much of this practice is to do with calming the waves and the storms in the mind. First, to know what an agitated mind looks like. To really notice what an apprehensive mind looks like. You know, what an anxious mind looks like. You know, without any judgment, just with a sense of curiosity. What does this look like? What does this feel like? You know, because again, it's reading our own experience as the place of our motivation to respond, you know. We can't just think of an abstract concept, you know, of, oh, it's a good idea to calm, you know. Actually, first, let's feel what not calm feels like. You know? And then have the sense, is this where we want to make our home? Is this what we want, where we want to make our home? Is this what we want to nurture? Is this what we want to cultivate? Or in the midst of this, do we actually cultivate some other way of being? So it's also sensing how calming is working hand in hand, not only with mindfulness, but also with investigation. That deep, intuitive, felt, experiential understanding. Now, calming the formations is calming all of those constructions, and particularly papancha. Particularly papancha. I think this is the greatest challenge of our life. Is to calm papancha. Everybody's familiar with this? Okay. You want to know one word in Pali? Ever going to forget all the other words in Pali I've said? This is the one to remember, papancha. Because papancha is what we experience a lot of our lives. Papancha is a proliferation of thinking that distorts our capacity to see things the way they actually are. You know, so here's an example for papancha. You know, I go outside at lunchtime, you know, I see there's a wedding going on. Oh, I remember when I got married. That was a really wonderful day. I wonder if these people really know what they're getting into. Maybe I got to give them a bit of advice. No, I shouldn't give them some advice. I'm not going to be mindful here. I'm not going to be... No, look, it's not a nice dress they're wearing. That's very lovely, you know. It's papancha. That is papancha. Now think of how much of our lives we spend in papancha, you know? This kind of story building, you know? And in Buddhist teaching, again, papancha is not just one tone. Papancha has emotional tones, you know? So there is aversion-based papancha, you know? Dosa papancha, you know? Oh, I really hate that. I hate everything about them. I hate their socks. I hate the way they do their hair, you know. And I remember, I'm sure everybody else hates that person. And look at what they're doing over there. Aversion-based papancha. It's tanha papancha. Craving-based papancha. Oh, look at that car. I'd really like a car like that. You know, I really need that kind of car. My kind of car is not very environmentally friendly. If I had that kind of car, everybody would really think I'm pretty... tanha-based papancha, huh? There is fear-based papancha. I'd really like to ask a question. Everybody's going to think I'm stupid if I ask that question. Everybody's always thought I'm stupid. I'm not going to ask that question. Maybe I should ask that question. It's fear-based papancha. Huh? There's view-based papancha. Ditti papancha. Huh? This woman doesn't know what she's talking about. I know a lot more about Buddhism than she knows about Buddhism. You know, I think if I had my way, you know, we would be doing this very differently. It would be a much better way to run this weekend, you know, if we weren't, she wasn't talking so much, we had more to say. It's view-based. Think of it in politics. Think of it in religion. Think of it, you know, it's view-based papancha. Huh? Craving, aversion, fear, view. Here's the other one. Mano-based papancha. Self based, self-view based papancha. You know? I'm such a terrible meditator, you know, if I was brighter I'd be a better meditator, you know. No, I'm such a terrific person, I'm such a terrible person, I'm a terrible person because I'm a meditator. The stories we weave about ourselves. Now, listen to the static in your mind, you know, and how much of it is this proliferation. And it's all agitated. Much of it is agitated. I mean, how much of that is intentional? You know? How much of that is useful? How much of it is kind? You know, and how much of it is kind of filling up the space and sort of think, you know, I think, therefore I am. And boy, are we good at it. But you can really see how papancha is a formation that is so habitual. It's P-A-P-A-N-C-A. A little squiggly bit under the C. Papancha. The proliferation of thinking, the storytelling. This is really, you know, at the core of much of our agitation. And this very sad thing is that it is an agitation we have become so accustomed to, it feels normal. It feels normal. Until you don't do it anymore. And then you think, that's not normal.
Does every culture, I mean, as far as you know, share this equally? Tibetans, you know, Africans, Americans. Does everyone, are they subject to the same Western world, just like monkey chatter prevention?
I don't really know the answer to that. I think you would have to ask, you know, someone more of an anthropologist or whatever. I mean, certainly different cultures do think differently. That I am very aware of. For example, like in Tibetan culture, they only had two words for emotion in Tibetan, happy and sad. You know, so under sad would be, you know, anger, fear, all of those. But there wasn't the tendency to kind of break them down in such a complex fashion. So there was clearly some emotions that were sad, and there were others that were happy. Well, you know, actually, if kind of changes our relationship to things, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It changes our way of thinking about things. You know, if you went into Inuit cultures, for example, where they don't have the concept of time that we have, don't find it useful, you know, still aren't inclined to use timepieces, because it's quite natural, you know, that the sun is rising, things happen when the sun rises, the sun sets, but, you know, it's not like, I got to get the fish in by 11, you know, you know, it's kind of... You know, so our way of thinking forms our world and forms how we approach our world. But I couldn't possibly say whether, you know, we excel in complexity. But and if you do remember, papancha is a Pali word from 2,600 years ago. I didn't make it up, you know. So something was going around 2,600 years ago in a fairly more simple cultures and communities where the mind was still doing this thing.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that is the answer.
You know, so the tendency of the mind to try to secure the world by thinking about it. That's really kind of what it's about, isn't it? It's a tendency of the mind to try and fix things in place by thinking about them. Every thought that we can possibly think about them. You know? No surprises. But the tendency to sort of construct worlds that then somehow gain this aura of credibility. I mean, that's the amazing thing. You know, and then we assume our papancha-created world is reality, you know. So that is terrible, you know, and that is... You know, without question. So papancha is, you know, and this is again a part of where mindfulness is working, because it's slowing down the process of papancha. So you begin to be able to trace this constructing process. If you can begin to see it, you can begin to question it, you can begin to investigate it, and you can begin to respond by knowing actually this is one of the most challenging pieces of our practice and our path, is to calm the waves of papancha. And they do calm. I mean, I'm sure you have experienced this in practice, you know, that indeed they do calm. But one can really, really get the sense of how agitation is fueling papancha. So it's kind of looking at the various ways that we come to agitation or begin to approach agitation, whether it's agitation in the body or whether it's agitation in the mind and in the formations.
Excuse me, I'm not sure if I heard correctly. Did you say it was fix things in place by thinking about them?
Yeah. I mean, nothing in this world is fixed apart from my view of it. Is it? Nothing. You know, nothing is fixed apart from my view of it.
When you say fix, you mean stop?
Solidified.
Like get a hold of it, try to capture it.
You know, do you ever get the sense of how much we're making this all up as we go along? You know, like when I go out into the world and say that's terrible and that's ugly and that's beautiful and that's lovely and, you know, that's amazing. You ever get a sense about how we're just making this up as we go along? How we're constructing and fixing the world in place through perception and our associations with it and our thoughts about it. Just kind of making it up as good. You know, how we really do live in our own personal little world. You know, because what is ugly to me is not at all ugly to somebody else. You know, what is exciting to me is not at all exciting to somebody else. It's kind of like my world, but I think it's the whole world. You know, and papancha is continually doing that, you know, by building the story and, you know, not seeing it. It's almost reaffirming, you know, my view and my world. And it all looks so real. And then we suffer because of it, you know. That's ugly. I have to be afraid of it. What made it ugly? It's good not to take this all too personally. But it's tremendously liberating just to know that I'm making a lot of this up as I go along.
The mind's intention is
fix things in place, make the world familiar, make it safe, make it in control. By knowing it or thinking I know it. Analyzing it, labeling it, naming it, categorizing it, classifying it. That then determines my relationship to it. I know how to respond to it because I've already perceived it and fixed it into this particular category. I mean, certainly in terms of Buddhist psychology, you know, there are a range of kind of sensory experience that could be said to be objective. You know, if very small range. You know, if someone came in here and kicked us all on the leg, we'd probably agree it was painful. Most of it is subjective. Most of it is subjective. You know, my views, my opinions, what I see to be desirable, what I see to be undesirable. What I fear, what I don't, this is much of this, you know, is pretty subjective. Occasionally we find friends who agree with us in our views, you know, and then we feel it's even more true, you know. if somebody else agrees, you know?
In that way, it's all self-based.
We are self-referencing all of the time, but even our sense of self is constructed. It can be remarkably freeing to know this. You know, because it just makes the whole thing, we just take it all a little bit less personally, and there's see a little bit more emptiness instead of seeing solidity. Feel a little bit freer to respond with actually what is helpful and skillful rather than trying to fit the world into this self-referencing all of the time. So Papancha is something really, really useful to be mindful of, you know, because invariably Papancha is going to send us on a wild goose chase. Mm-hmm. It's going to send us somewhere which is actually affirming a view rather than connecting us with what is. So calming the agitation of Papancha is a huge, huge... I mean, I don't know how it is for you in practice, but, you know, how much time in practice does your mind actually spend in Papancha? I mean, it's something, and it becomes, of course, a habit pattern, doesn't it? It becomes a habit pattern. And sometimes it looks really attractive, you know, particularly, you know, like tanha-based Papancha, particularly, you know, fantasy. You know, building those scenarios of what might be, you know. It looks kind of attractive, but what you have to appreciate is the habit of Papancha does not have a conscience. So it's not as if we can only choose to have Papancha around pleasant scenarios and then not have Papancha around unpleasant or fearful ones. It is the habit pattern that is kind of more toxic than the content. So, I mean, I think, it, you know, because that, you know, that would be maybe nice if we could do that. You know, only have fantasy-based Papancha and not anxiety-based Papancha. But you see, there's no choice there. If the habit pattern is there, it is going to go, depending on the emotional state that is present, it's going to go equally down that road. So we're kind of calming the agitation of the habit. Which actually, you know, looks like a pretty big gift to ourselves, doesn't it? A lot of it, you know, especially with the Papancha, which is always trying to fix and label and categorize and put things in place, you know, so much that fear-based Papancha. You know? And, you know, as a Christian mystic once said that anxiety is the mood of ignorance. That anxiety is the mood of not knowing how things actually are. Ignorance. We begin to learn how to steady the mind. And, you know, again, I mean, don't have time to do this, but mind is also something to turn into a verb. You know, because we use this word mind in capital letters all the time, you know, usually preceded by my mind. In reality, what you see that the mind is living in a state of potentiality. Huh? There is a process of minding that is going on. Sometimes minding is shaped by thinking, sometimes minding is emotionally shaped, you know, sometimes minding is intentionally shaped, sometimes minding is creatively shaped, sometimes minding is shaped by fear or aversion. But it's very important to see, you know, just as we talked about the change in views of self in a day, think of the change in shapes of your mind in a day. And really having a sense that there is nothing fixed in the mind. And what I think this teaching is speaking to is actually to the acknowledgement that if the mind truly is living in a state of potentiality, then there is no helplessness here. Because we are cultivating intentionality, we are cultivating what is kusala or ennobling, you know, we are cultivating what is skillful, so we are cultivating a mind that is a friend. and a mind that is truly a refuge. And I think that's so important to acknowledge, because there's nothing here about annihilating the mind or regarding the mind as an obstacle or regarding the mind as a problem, but seeing that the mind is holding these seeds of potentiality within it, and what the seed that we cultivate will become the shape of the mind. So training the mind in steadiness, training the mind in non-papancha, I think truly is a training. It truly is an education, you know. And I think, you know, one-pointedness, calming, investigation, mindfulness are all part of this training. And as we were talking about this morning, calming, sometimes finding something that is calm in the midst of agitation. Finding what is calm in the midst of agitation. Learning to cultivate undistractedness. Learning to apply and sustain attentiveness. Learning to apply and sustain attentiveness. This is so much of what we are doing in the practice. I think there is also a deeper investigation here, because, you know, when I talked about the sort of infatuation with events, it's because events are self-making, aren't they? That's how we create, how the event of selfing is created in relationship to other events. You know, a sound arises, I'm thinking, you know. A memory arises, I remember that, you know. An emotion arises, I'm happy, I'm sad. So essentially, the world of events and the world of selfing have to be working in partnership. You don't see a sense of self standing alone. That selfing and events, the event of self and the events of the body-mind world, are working cooperatively. So, which gives much of a clue about why we tend to be so infatuated with events and intensity and excitement, you know? Because the bigger the event, the bigger the me. Huh? The more substantial the me. The more substantial the event, the more substantial me. So you can see why we have an allergy at times, it seems, to stillness. I mean, it doesn't make any sense intellectually, doesn't it? Because if we've ever tasted stillness, we know the sweetness of it. You know, we know the calmness and the spaciousness of it. But isn't it interesting then that that we can seem to have such an allergy to stillness? And spend instead much more of our time seeking out excitement, seeking out, you know, stimulation, seeking out events, because guess how what? That's how I get sustenance. That's how I get a formation. On its deepest level, I would translate mindfulness as eventlessness. Because if you look at what an event is, I mean, if you look at your mind, look at your body, you know, look at this moment, what you see, isn't it? There's a whole stream of sights, of sounds, of sensations in your body right now, of feelings, of thoughts. If you really get a sense, it's just kind of this ongoing stream. Now, if I isolate something in that stream through craving or aversion, not through intention, but through craving or aversion or reaction, when I isolate something in that stream, it becomes an event. So we could be sitting here with this whole stream of feelings, sensations, thoughts, and again, maybe the car alarm goes off. If I glom onto that, start to proliferate about it, I create an event out of that car alarm. And I also create me. There's also the, can't say I create me. Me is created with that identification. becomes an event. Now you notice when we make an event how there's a loss of connection with that stream of life. Right? So what are we learning to do with mindfulness is actually to sort of be pretty much kind of be attuned with that ongoing changing stream and not fixating upon anything within it, no event making. The Buddha used the analogy of house building. You know, and he used it in this rather scathing way, you know, oh, you house builders, you know. He used this much more this analogy of house building, and he talked about sort of taking away the ridgepole, you know, taking away the supports. No more house building. It's kind of like no more event making. No more event making. Because if there's no more event making through clinging and through fixating, there is no more making of the event of self. Instead, there is that attunement just aligned with that stream of experience, stream of life. It's why sometimes mindfulness is described as eventlessness. From our contemporary cultural point of view, this is completely unacceptable. You imagine an old friend turning up at your door and asking how you are, saying, nothing's happening. How was yesterday? Nothing happened, you know. How about tomorrow? Nothing's happening, you know. And it's not that life is not happening, but event making is not happening. And, you know, conventionally that makes us no one, doesn't it? That makes us no one because we haven't got the story of self to tell, and the story of self is the story of events, isn't it? It's not that things don't occur, and please understand how I'm using this. You know, it's not as if life doesn't occur and ask for our response, you know, and this stream of experience, of course, asks for our response and our care and our compassion and kindness. So please don't think that I'm sort of dismissing that. But it's this level of trying to freeze frame life. Freeze frame life in the sense of self-eventing. On the deepest level, when I say that mindfulness is eventlessness, it's because there's a calming of the formations. Calming the formations of fear. Calming the formations of selfing. You know, calming the formations of craving. That there is no isolating or event making. And that is really, I think, a very profound serenity of body and mind in all circumstances. And it's alive and responsive. It's alive and responsive. So that's serenity. You may have any questions about serenity, about calming, before we have a break?
I have just a quick observation. Every time I've heard a teacher go into the monologue of Papancha, I notice there's creates a tremendous amount of laughter and all that. And I asked myself, I was wondering why it was, and it dawned on me that it's so familiar. And
yes, we know it.
In our brain, and so it sounds so familiar. It's hilarious.
Yes. And then when we think about it, when we really kind of stand outside and look at it, we just see it's kind of psychological and emotional vandalism. So it's like graffiti in consciousness. And it kind of like, we think, why would I do that to myself? You know, why would I do that to myself? But then we really see the habit part, that it's not always the content part. Although you can see that the bigger the mental state, the more papancha. You know, and the bigger the emotion, the bigger the story. That's good to see. You know, because when we talk about calming the formations and calming the mental states, you can see, you know, like when there's a mental state of some calmness or some peacefulness, the storytelling calms with it. And you can also see that the skillful and the wholesome creates very little storytelling. Whereas the more unskillful, the more unskillful something is, I think the more storytelling it creates. You know, because we have to justify it, we have to explain it, you know, we have to legitimize it, you know, we have to make sense of it. It's interesting. I think spiritual urgency has a kind of focus. You know, it's informed by a sense of valuing. It's informed by a sense of intentionality. It has a direction. And, you know, it doesn't have this sense of agitation, although agitation can seize on to spiritual urgency. Can. I've seen that. You know, when I used to practice in Asia, you would see people, you know, striving for their own Bodhi tree experience, you know. And there was a spiritual urgency there, but there was a lot of agitation too. But agitation is, as far as I can see, it's pretty devoid of all of those things of intention, of values, of having a sense of direction, of cultivation. And it's pretty devoid of all of those things. It's primarily an unpleasant experience. Primarily an unpleasant experience. But it can glom on to anything, including spiritual urgency. But then you get the feel of it. You get the feel of agitation. It has that feel of tension, of leaning forward, you know, haste.